Hello, everybody. So today, I'm going to tell you about monadrifolds. Monadrifolds. New word. Everyone, pay close attention. These are non-geometric compactifications in string theory. This started with some work I did a couple years ago with Simeon Hellerman and John McGreevy. The current project I'm working with Alex Flournoy, who's at Technion now, and Brian Wecht, who is in San Diego. He'll be at MIT next year. I should note while we're here, the HEP theory number here. The first time I gave a version of this talk, this said 03 11 and then some question marks. So I'll get a little bit into the reason it was so delayed, but see how things go. String theory, in spite of its aspirations as a fundamental theory of quantum gravity, is for the most part heavily reliant on classical notions of geometry. This being said, we know that strings see this geometry in a very different way than an ordinary point particle would. So some instances of that, we know that there's geometries that look singular to a point particle that, from a string's perspective, are perfectly smooth. We can understand them. There's also notions like t-duality, which relate backgrounds which, from a point particle's perspective, look very different. There are different volumes. And even in more general backgrounds, compactifications, you have mirror symmetry, which will even relate different topologies. So strings certainly see this background very differently, but we're still thinking, we're relating with t-duality, we're relating two different geometries that we would have from a point particle's point of view. So we're still pretty stuck up here in this classical geometry. There is at least one well-known background which is very different from something that a point particle could see, and these are asymmetric orbifolds. So due to the natural splitting of the string into left and right movers, you can actually allow the left-moving side of the string to see something different, see a different geometry than the right-moving side of the string. So this has there's no interpretation of this in terms of ordinary geometry. So it'd be nice to develop a theory which, nice to develop a formulation of the theory which is more intrinsic to the way strings see their backgrounds than instead of the way point particles see their backgrounds. So to have a theory in which non-geometric backgrounds and geometric backgrounds that we're used to from general relativity all are just different parts of the same moduli space. So, in an effort to push towards doing that, we're going to study some of the non-geometric backgrounds today. And you might ask, you know, is this just, well, A, you know, how much progress are you going to make? And that's a bigger question. But also, just more down-to-earth question, how interesting are these asymmetric backgrounds? They seem kind of goofy. Is this something that we have to think about in the real world? And I would argue they are very important, actually. And we can see that in a lot of cases. So a couple of examples are, we know from, there was some work done by Shamit Kachru, Trivedi, Schultz, I think someone else, this new supersymmetric compactifications in string theory, where they made these comments in their paper how if you start with a collabial with fluxes in some background and you perform an odd number of t-dualities, you end up with something which is non-geometric. So you take these flux compactifications, which we know are very important right now, and you go to some dual theory and it has a non-geometric description. And also, Simeon, in addition to going to see movies, has told me that he's worked out, if you just start with the conifold with fluxes on it, which is important for the obvious reasons, again there, if you can look at the mirror of this of this background, and you show that you can show that it's non-geometric. So this is certainly something that is related, is dual to a lot of things that are of current interest. And again, there's, I think, from a more theoretical standpoint, an interest in trying to develop a framework which captures all of these. So I'll start by reviewing the work I did with John and Simeon. Tell you a little about stringy symmetries, monodromy, and I'll tell you what a monodrifold is. I'll give a description of it, and this, I gave a talk here when the first paper came out, and this will be kind of review up to there. And then I'll go into the orbifold limit, and I probably mentioned this when I gave my first talk, but I want to describe it in a little more detail. I think it really gives you a good picture of what's going on here. If you understand the orbifold limit, it helps you understand that. Also, it's good. We're going to be able to, from the orbifold limit, try to think about S-duality and get a heterotic version of the work we had originally done with John and Simeon. After that, I'll talk about new compactifications that we've been looking at and describe them, and then say a little bit about what's next. So let's start by just discussing the type 2 string compactified on a torus. The compactification has two moduli, given by the complex structure, which I'm calling tau, and the complexified Kähler modulus rho here. And we know the symmetry group here just breaks up nicely into an SL2Z cross SL2Z, where this SL2Z gives you the geometric transformations of the torus, and this SL2Z comes from B-field shifts in T-duality. So what can you do with this? Well, something which was something you can do is allow for monodromies. So if you have some point in your space which is singular, as you have some singularity, as you go around that singularity, you no longer have to come back up to where you started. So if you have a non-trivial cycle, as you go around, you come back to where you started, instead of coming back up to the same compactification you had in the beginning, you just have to come up with something which is equivalent up to some SL2Z cross SL2Z transformation. So in particular, for the compactifications we're looking at, if you have some torus vibration which has singularities at certain points, you can imagine going around and then coming back up to, say, the T-dual of yourself, which I've tried to picture here. So you could ask, why do you want to do that? So one good answer is you can. And this is, I'm not being facetious. This is really, we're trying to understand string backgrounds. If there is a possibility of doing something, we should check and see if it's interesting and what happens in that area. Also, it might have interesting properties. There might be good reasons to do this. So let's take this example I gave here, where you have some torus and you travel around in some circle and you come back up to some other torus. Well, we know when we compactify on a torus, we're going to end up with moduli, namely fluctuations. We start with some background given by tau and rho, but some fixed background, but then there can be fluctuations about that that lead to light scalars in the lower dimensional theory. So what happens if we have something where, as you travel around, say rho goes to minus 1 over rho? Well, we start with some rho, which is fixed. In the lower dimensional theory, there's going to be some light scalar, which effectively corresponds to rescaling rho. So as rho fluctuates, as the modulus fluctuates, you go from rho to, say, rho prime, which I'm just giving by rescaling of rho, so some lambda rho. Well, if we look at rho prime, as rho prime goes around here, we know it should come back up to minus rho prime. I mean, minus 1 over rho prime. But as you travel around, taking rho to minus 1 over rho, you come back up to minus lambda over rho, which is not minus 1 over rho prime, except for when lambda is equal to 1. So you could see this modulus, which corresponds to lambda, is projected out of your theory.
So remind me, you said you can do this. What is the stringy object that resolves this
inequality again? No, we had some big discussion about it during my first talk on this subject. But I didn't have a good answer then. And then I went and figured out the answer, and now it's been a year and a half. The object in which tau goes to minus 1 over tau is given by a Kaluza-Klein monopole. All right. So one answer is it's the t-dual of that object. But if you ask what that is, it's some sort of composite object of brains. And I forget exactly what the combination is, but it's a composite. It's like 3 brains and 5 brains mixed in some funny way.
You have carefully checked that there is a stringy object.
I haven't, but Moore and people did a long time ago when they were doing F-theory. And these objects were in terms of 7 brains and 5 brains and something. But they're, yes. So it's some funny combinations of brains. But the easiest thing is to say it's the t-dual of a Kaluza-Klein monopole.
What's the Kaluza-Klein monopole part again?
Well, the Kaluza-Klein monopole has this monodromy. So you could think about the Kaluza-Klein monopole as this dimensional reduction of Talbot space.
Right.
And so, testing all my thoughts. Okay, hold on. I'm not going to be able to work this out in real time. I know this was something I checked. If you could check that the Kaluza-Klein monopole, when you dimensionally reduce the scalar that comes from dimensional reduction on the circle, if you go around the point where the tip of the Kaluza-Klein monopole actually jumps.
Oh, so
in
the
a torus
balance. Comes from, well, one circle from reducing and one from the original.
Right.
The circle that gives you
the one. So, I mean, this is a nice picture of if you're wanting to understand really what's happening here. You have the Kaluza-Klein monopole I think is well understood by people. And then when I start talking about the toroidal compactifications, it's a little more confusing. But the Kaluza-Klein monopole kind of looks like this half cigar, right? And you can dimension, if you have some fiber, which is a Kaluza-Klein monopole, there's some point where it shrinks to zero size. And the way we should be thinking about these singular fibrations that I'm talking about is kind of where you've gone ahead. This is a horrible drawing. But where you've basically taken, instead of a half cigar, a full cigar, and kind of bent it around and touched the tips together. And the point where the tips touch together is where the fiber's degenerating.
The Kaluza-Klein monopole has an additive charge, whereas rho goes to minus 1 over rho squared is z2 value. How do you?
Then
would be able to annihilate, right? Or,
what do you mean by the Kaluza-Klein monopole has an additive charge?
I mean, a monopole and anti-monopole are different.
Rho can go to minus 1 over rho in 2 different directions. So rho goes to minus 1 over rho is a t-duality and a 90-degree rotation.
It's a 4.
Yes, so.
So 4 give you back the trivial thing.
Well, so we need to be careful. So I talked to you about this in your office one day. Because
I don't
believe you. But this is probably right. Okay. There's this question. This is an interesting thing that's come out of this, which has confused me. And I asked Joe, and he didn't believe me, but didn't give me a good answer. You don't believe we talked about this. So there's this question of, does T duality square to 1? Of course it does, right? Well, let's talk about what rho goes to minus 1 over rho does. Or minus 1 over rho. Okay, sorry, not does T duality square to 1. So rho goes to minus 1 over rho. If you do this twice, you get rho goes to rho. But what have you done? You've taken rho to minus, you've done two T dualities and a 90 degree rotation, and then you do it again, and you do two T dualities and another 90 degree rotation. And so the monodromy matrix for this is minus 1. So rho goes to minus 1 over rho has the monodromy matrix minus 1. I mean, if you square this, right? Because you can do the 90 degree rotation in two directions. So if you do this twice, you really have monodromy matrix minus 1. And I think the question you're asking is, it's the same thing for the Klutz-Klein monopole. You get this minus 1 monodromy matrix. But on the NS sectors, it's has this negative...
I guess I'm so confused. If I take 4 there,
then you get all the way
back to itself. But if I take 4 Klutz-Klein monopoles, I just have 4 units of negative charge.
There's a chance I'm saying something wrong. I mean, this is aspects of it I haven't thought about, you know, since I wrote the original paper. Maybe I'm doing something wrong in my memory, but I think what I'm saying is correct. But okay. I'll go back and check and do that.
If you're really claiming this is dual of Klutz-Klein monopole, then you're claiming this also has an additive charge to it, to some kind of topological winding number or the number of torus bundle around the singularity.
I'm sorry. No, you're exactly right. I said something completely wrong. The Klutz-Klein monopole is dual to an NS5 brain. An NS5 brain is the monodromy that takes rho to rho plus n.
Yes.
If you take a stack of n NS5 brains. So now going back to your original question, I knew tau goes to minus 1 over tau again has a easier description, but I'm forgetting what it is.
So, well, rho goes to rho plus 1 is a 7 brain, which is one of these stringy cosmic strings.
Right.
And anything which is conjugate to rho goes to rho plus 1 is some other version of the
some PQ brain of some sort.
Now, this is not conjugate to that, but this is a conjugate to a product of these, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so, a product of things which are conjugate to rho goes to rho plus 1. And so this at least could be obtained by taking several different kinds of stringy cosmic string and bringing it together.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
That's how in the context of 7 brains you get these, you know,
right.
Funny monodromy.
Yeah.
Which brings up another question. Is it monodromy or monodromy?
Half the people say one thing, half people say the other thing. I think I say both.
Okay, well, is it monodromy-fold or...
I claim it's monodrophold,
okay,
because monodrophold sounds goofy.
Okay.
In this case, you used to call U-manifolds at some point.
This is very similar to U-manifolds. It's a slightly different symmetry group. It's done in a different context.
Well, you have a duality group.
They're related to U-manifolds. It's constructed in a different way. And they're related to you.
But I was using an SL3Z as opposed to SL2 from
SL2. Well, yeah, I mean, it's they cover a lot of the same moduli space. I don't think it's identical, but there is overlap. Okay.
If this comes from just coincident 7 brains, then why shouldn't I think of this just in terms of some F-theory?
Well, these are actually coincident 5 brains here.
Right.
It's the same story as an F-theory, but not done, but done from a 10-dimensional perspective. All right. So how are we going to proceed? How are we going to construct compact solutions from this? And we're going to do the same thing that's been done for years with F-theory compactifications, which is we're going to work in this semi-flat approximation where we understand the physics close to these singularities in terms of some ADE-type singularities can describe the strings. And then far away from that, we assume things are basically flat and we can just use supergravity. And as I'll show on the next slide, you can include the right number of singularities and it ends up being a compact manifold. All right. I'm going to rush through this a bit because this is all review. This is just setup. So what do you learn from the supergravity? So if we're far away from these singularities, what do we learn? Well, from looking at the variation of the gravitino along the fiber, you can show that rho and tau are holomorphic. And this is going to be important later on. You also get this equation from the dilatino relating, but you can kind of forget about that for the rest of the talk. The other important equation also comes from the variation of the gravitino, but this time along the base. So if you go to conformal gauge on the base, you find that your equation of motion, or your constraint coming from the supergravity looks like this. And if you then you can solve this. And it's pretty easy to solve. You could put in Green's functions and solve it in some analytic way. But you can also kind of guess the solution by first just saying, well, I want this thing inside the parentheses to be 0. And then you say, well, since that's 0, it's going to describe my metric. But then you go up here and you have to impose modular invariance. And you have to impose the fact that it doesn't vanish anywhere. So when you do that, by putting in eta functions to fix up the modular invariance and dividing out by these zeros to get rid of places that it vanishes, you can just write down the solution. And this is all worked out in a stringy cosmic strings back like 92. And then you could show, well, if you move far away from any of these points that are singular, your metric looks something like this. Well, for n equals to 24, you just plug that in here and you have a metric that looks like this. And well, lo and behold, you can do this transformation, and it just looks like a flat metric. And the transformation you're doing is just defining u as 1 over z. And we know this is just the transition functions for on a sphere. So it's described by two patches. It has these sphere transition functions. So it's clear this is just going to be a sphere. So the idea is you have these little places where there's some singular vibration, and this causes the base to back react and bend a little bit. And if you include exactly 24 of these little degenerations, it's going to curl up into a sphere. It's a funny sphere that has these little points in it where there's these singularities, but it's a compact manifold.
Is the whole four-dimensional geometry singular?
No, the four-dimensional geometry is smooth. So
just the picture of it is a vibration.
It's just the vibration which is singular. So this singular vibration is exactly what would be expected from the SYZ conjecture when they talked about how collabials have these supersymmetric T3 vibrations, and but these vibrations necessarily degenerate at certain
but
points.
This particular four-dimensional case is like K3 or something?
So what I've described to date, depending on what kind of monodromies you put in here, if you have all geometric monodromies, this is exactly a K3. In fact, when discussing F-theory compactifications, this is what they do. They build these, they do exactly what we've done, but the only thing different from what we did and what they did is they said, well, here we have to include just the geometric symmetries, and we're including this mixing. I mean, I get sometimes with the F-theory compactifications, they use NS5 grains or something, but they don't use the mixing of it. And the mixing is really what gives you something non-geometric. And that can be seen in a couple ways. And one is just if you start with something which are all, say, non-geometric, all row degenerations, and you titleize, you're going to end up with something that's all tau degeneration. So clearly this is in some sense geometric. And another thing, it really is, you know, I made these comments at the beginning. So what makes something non-geometric? It took me a long time to really decide what non-geometric meant. And finally, in the end, what I've decided it means to me is that the metric and beef, you have this complexified Kähler form. And this is very important in string theory. Like, it naturally arises, and people talk about it all the time. But people, and this is what allows for mirror symmetry, and this is what allows for the flop transition. And it's very important that the Kähler form complexifies in the way it does. But usually when people talk about it, they talk about it as there's a symmetric and anti-symmetric part which can be decomposed, and they don't mix. And really, to me, when I say something's non-geometric, what I mean is as you move around in space, there's points where as you go around them and you come back up to yourself, components of the what was your anti-symmetric part of the complexified Kähler form and what was your symmetric part mixed together. And it's really the mixing of the metric and B field, I think, which defines something as being non-geometric.
That's what happens
in the asymmetric overfold. It's certainly what happens here. I think with the asymmetric overfold, something probably similar happens, but it's harder. I don't have as nice of a description of it. And because you start talking about the left and right movers mixing, and it's harder to describe. So, but this is the way I think about, at least in the context of these compactifications, something being non-geometric. So, what we do, I'll give a few more details. Kadaira was nice enough to give us a classification many, many years ago, which related monodromies to some ADE type singularity and told you the order of the degeneration and stuff. This is all done in terms of elliptic vibrations. So what's normally done for the K3 case is you define some Weierstrass equation which is 24th order. So it being 24th order means it's going to vanish in 24 places. So the total order of the degeneration is be 24, and that's what gives you the 24 degenerations to make your space a compact space. Now, something we noticed when looking at the list, and I just have some of them written up here, is they tend to come in pairs. So they've described the different fiber types, like 3 and 3 star, for instance. And if you look at the total order of the degeneration, it's 9 plus 3, which is equal to 12. And 6 and 6, which is equal to 12. And the other ones tend to combine to 12. These pairs have inverse monodromies of each other, if you want to. So, well, what does this tell you? Well, nothing really. You could have done this in a lot of different ways, but we made this, you know, insightful insight, which is that 12 plus 12 is equal to 24. So we were looking for something with 24 degenerations, and we said, well, what we'll do is just take two pairs, and we'll have 12 from one pair and 12 from another pair, and we'll have one of the 12 correspond to row degenerations, and one of the 12 correspond to tau degenerations. And the fact that these are inverses of this, it tells you that the total monodromy around these pairs is going to be one. So that kind of allows you to glue them together in a nice way. You might think if you go around some pair and it didn't have total monodromy 1, it might be hard to glue to some other pair. So we have something that looked like this, and we called it a 12 plus 12 prime model. And we wrote out these elliptic vibrations and calculated spectrums and did all kinds of things. It was quite fun. Kind of a side note in our paper is, well, I don't want to say the side note yet. So as we said, the K3 can be described in the exact same way, and it only has tau degenerations. Also, we know you can describe the K3 as just the blow-up of an orbifold. And as a side note in our paper, that you can show there's a special point in moduli space where these 12 plus 12 prime models correspond to asymmetric orbifolds. And I'll go into detail about what that asymmetric orbifold is. But we have something which is built exactly like a K3. It has a limit which is an asymmetric orbifold. So it's kind of natural to think of these 12 plus 12 primes as blow-ups of asymmetric orbifolds.
Why do you want some non-complex fraction information?
Excuse me?
There's more than one type of resolution of singularities. So blow-up is the one where you just, it's very geometric.
Right. So we're being very loose with the word blow-up here. It's not... It's an analogy, but there's no way, well, it'd be difficult to describe it geometrically. Since it's
do you identify the modes on the asymmetric orbifold that take you in Hawking's direction?
Yeah, and well, it depends on what detail you mean, but I mean, I think I understand what they are. But I'm about to describe the orbifold in a lot of detail. So let me do that, and then if we have questions, we'll go back. So this orbifold is actually a very, very mild sort of asymmetric orbifold. And in fact, it's obvious what it is. I could cover it up, and you guys should be able to tell me. but it wasn't obvious to us for a very, very long time. So I'll go ahead and humor you and describe it to you. So what is it? Well, I've written down exactly what it is down here, and we'll go into that in a second. But I just want to start by describing the fixed points. So the fixed points are, it's a T3 cross R, and you mod out by two Z2s. And one of the Z2s is just your ordinary Z2, where it reflects one of the coordinates. So you know you're going to get singularities at 0 and at pi on your T3s. So you get orbifold singularities. The other Z2 is an inversion, just like we had before, but it also includes a shift, which just basically has the effect of separating it out. So we started with T3 cross R. So this second Z2 pulls these singularities off by some distance L, and also includes this minus 1 to the F left. So if you look at these two orbifold points here, it looks like R mod Z2, and these here look like R mod Z2 with this minus 1 to the F left. So why did I say this was so obvious? Well, I said, as I said a second ago, K3 in type 2A is just T4 mod Z2. And so you know each of the orbifold singularities just looks like R. This should be an R4, so should that. R4 mod Z2. Okay. But then how do you get from type 2A to type 2B? You can change the GSO projection, but it's effectively just overfolding by minus 1 to the F left. So what it looks like here is we've taken half of our singularities, and they just look like type 2. If you were around that, if you were going around that overfold singularity and someone said, what are you doing? You would think you lived on a K3 in type 2A. But if you were over here around this singularity, you would think you were on a K3 in type 2B. So in some sense, we've glued together half of a K3 on type 2A with half of a K3 in type 2B. And the reason that should be obvious is, what do we have? We have half a little sphere with D4 singularities. And this is what you would expect in the K3 situations. And here you have the same thing, but with D4 primes. But D4 primes, if you just titulize, become D4s. So, but what happens when you titulize? You interchange type 2A and type 2B.
What's a D4 prime?
Okay, so D4 primes are, they're D4, the D4 is the kind of singularity it is. And the primes correspond to one that corresponds to changes in rho, and the unprimes correspond to changes in tau. Sorry, I kind of rushed through that part of the.
So, this is not asymmetric?
It is asymmetric because of this minus 1 to the F left, which is.
On the one hand, you're describing it in terms of a physical left and right half of your space. And on the other hand, the asymmetric orbital is left movers and right movers.
Right. I mean left movers and right movers when I say asymmetric. I mean, the left and right hand of my space is, this is just kind of pictures. I could pull these singularities apart, put them in all different combinations. You shouldn't think about it as sides. It's just easier to draw that way. But the asymmetry, the reason I said it was a very mild sort of asymmetric overfold is because it is asymmetric in the fact that it has this minus 1 to the f left.
You go between 2b by titulating on an odd number of axes. How do you get an odd? This all is separate. You took everything on even numbers. So in what sense are they turn one to the other?
Well, no, if you do a single t, so what we've done, this is all in the context of type 2a. But what I'm saying here is, if you just look at the orbifold points, this point here, these points here, look like the same as the orbifold point for type 2, for singularity coming from type 2b. Locally, in some sense, it looks like type 2b on a K3. And then I'm just pointing out that this D4 prime, just pick a cycle, titulize, and that would, there's a dual picture of this half of it that looks like K3 on type 2b. And it's important you include both of them, you know, as I was saying, for this mixing. But again, you know, so if you titulize the whole thing, of course, on one cycle, maybe you'll switch these and these. So really, it's not, you're working in type 2a. You're not doing type 2a and type 2b at the same time. But you can use this intuition to kind of guess what the overfolds.
Do you have any global description of the moduli space of these?
No. Which I said something I think is a really interesting question.
K3 is so explicit. This.
Yeah, I mean, you know how to move around in moduli space. It's basically from this point of view of breaking up these singular fibers, and mathematicians are really good at doing this. You basically corresponds to multiplying matrices together, right? You get n equals, well, with rho and tau varying, you get n equals 1, 6 dimensions. So, what else can we do here? Well, now we can talk about a heterotic dual. So let's go back to the type 2a for a second. And this is actually new stuff, finally. So let's think about the U1s contained in this orbifold here, if you look at a T4 mod Z2. Well, you're going to get, from the twisted sector, each of the R4 mod Z2s are going to contain a vector. So you get six, because there's 16 fixed points, you're going to get 16 U1s in the twisted sectors. And you're also going to get 8 U1s in the untwisted sector. We know this is S dual to heterotic on a T4. So where's the analogous thing going on over here? Well, if you just dimensionally reduce, if you're working in the bosonic formulation of the heterotic string, the 16 U1s here are going to come from the dimensional reduction from these internal directions. And the 8 U1s come from the metric and B field. So now let's ask what happens if you take the K3 and you mod out by minus 1 to the F left. What's the S dual of that? Well, it's kind of a funny question to be asking. You know, it's like I'm basically asking, what's the S dual of type 2b? And the answer is almost T4 mod W, where W is defined as an inversion of all the directions on your lattice. So why do I say this? Well, this is something that was worked out by Vafa and Witten in the mid-90s. And they were doing it for a very different reason. What they were interested in was compactifications, dual theories with lower amounts of supersymmetry. But what they showed was, if you take K3 cross S1 and you mod out by minus 1 to the F left with a shift, where you're integrating a shift into this orbifold. Now note, this isn't like a Z2 cross Z2. This is one Z2 element here. And this is a type of interpolating orbifold, which I'm going to discuss in the last slide. I'll go into details about. But if you take this theory here, that its S dual is given by T4 cross S1 mod W, where you have this additional action in here, minus 1 to the N plus W. This minus 1 to the N plus W here, if you just started with W, your theory wouldn't be modular invariant. And by including this here, you end up with a theory which is modular invariant. And Waffen went into detail about how these things matched up. So you can almost immediately guess, and your guess turns out to be right, what the type 2, what an analogous situation here. Here we have our 12 plus 12 prime model cross an S1. And what we're interested in here is 12 of them look like K3 singularities, which you're not doing anything to. And 12 of them come from these type 2B K3 singularities. So I don't really mean in type 2B, but in some sense. So what would this be dual to? Well, you can just take T4 cross S1 mod W prime with this same factor here. And what is this W prime? This W prime is just an inversion of the 4 torus and 8 of the internal directions. So you can kind of go back to these U1s and see what's happening is when you orbifold by minus 1 to the F left, it kills all of these here. And the W does the same thing. Obviously, these all have one leg here, so if you do an inversion, all of these are going to be killed by the orbifold. But since now we want to go back and we only are going to do minus 1 to the F left on 8 of the singularities. So for 8 of the orbifold, the 8 of the fixed points are going to have these 6 or U1s, and 8 of them aren't. So we still want to kill these, and then we're going to kill half of these. So the guess is, well, why don't we not do an inversion on 8 of the directions? And this turns out to work. So we don't have a heterotic description of the 12 plus 12 prime model, but by going down one more dimension, we can give a heterotic dual to it. So you look very upset. No. Okay. So what's next? So I'm going to kind of go in a different direction now. Our goal when we started this project was to give a heterotic description, 12 plus 12 prime. And after thinking for a while, we realized that in the original paper, we did the hard thing first. And it was in some sense the obvious thing to do, because K3s have been built like this. If you were familiar with F theory, really the only thing we did was enlarge the symmetry group. It was in some sense trivial. It was hard to figure out how to calculate the spectrum and stuff, but the idea was simple enough. So, but maybe we could do something else. So I said having some point where your fiber degenerates allows you to have a monodrome as you go around in some closed loop. Well, really, the important point isn't the degenerating fiber. The important point is that you have a non-trivial cycle. So what if you started with compactification where your base had a non-trivial cycle on it, so a torus, for instance? So here, again, you can go around some closed loop, and you can come back up, and you can have some monodromy. So does this really simplify things? Does it make it harder? I mean, going the torus certainly doesn't make, you know, calculating one loop amplitudes are a lot harder than not. But it is a huge simplification here. And the reason is because the T2 base is non-singular. Now, I told you before that the equations of motion imply that rho and tau are holomorphic functions. But we know from the maximum modulus principle, if you have some holomorphic function and it's on some non-singular compact space, that it's going to be constant. So in particular, rho and tau have to be constant. So this is a tremendous simplification. So I just did the simplest example, where, I mean, you could do combinations of these to get more complicated things, but if you just want to use one element, rho and tau don't have fixed points, so we won't use those. And we'll just take rho goes to minus 1 over rho in one cycle, and tau goes to minus 1 over tau in the other cycle. So what you find here is that rho and tau have to be constant. They have to, so you can actually change these arrows to equal signs. So they have to lie at some fixed point. So you have rho and tau is equal to I. So at this point, you might be saying, well, that's really, really boring. You haven't done anything, right? Like, you just have some compactification. It doesn't look non-geometric at all. I don't understand why you're doing this. And there's a very good reason to do this. These are compactifications. The only way to really make sense of these compactifications is from the lower dimensional theory. So we want to ask what the six-dimensional physics looks like. And though you might look at this background and say, well, it has, this background is just some T2 cross a T2, which has no B field and, you know, flat, you know, just one for the metric on the fiber T2. But when you compactify, you go to six dimensions, start looking at the spectrum, the moduli coming from rho and tau are lifted. They're not in your theory. So the six-dimensional physics is different because you have different fields in your theory. So that's much simpler. So I said we wanted to start talking about the heterotic string. Well, nice thing about the heterotic string is it has this very large symmetry group. So you, instead of having 022, comma z, ignore those twos, you have 018, comma 2z. So This is what makes phenomenology so nice when you're doing heterotic string. I mean, this is great. But if you want to do something analogous to what Simeon and John and I did, analogous to these 12 plus 12 prime models, it's very, very difficult to describe these vibrations. So you might think you could just describe this as this, you know, this 18-dimensional fiber and go through jumps. And this probably could be done in principle. I've looked at mathematicians have worked out a lot on talking about like degenerate four-dimensional fibers, and it's horrendous and confusing, and that's at four dimensions. And jumping another 16 dimensions and kind of modding out by half the directions, on the right-hand side of the world sheet, it just would get very confusing. So I think in principle it could be done, but it's really, really hard. But if we want to describe the heterotic string on these compactifications, it's very simple, because everything just lies at fixed points of the moduli. Okay, so I'm going to start rushing through some stuff. So if I get going too fast, just tell me. So we start with the heterotic string on a T2 cross T2. And we're going to embed that into the 26-dimensional bosonic string. This has all been worked out a long time ago, how to do this. There's a nice review by Givian and Parati and someone else that talks about how to do this. And in particular, you could just take your background, this E plus G plus B, like this. It has this kind of off-diagonal form. And it basically comes from the fact that you can either think about, you know, getting rid of the right-hand side of your string on the internal lattice, or you can think about it as it's reducing the number of components coming from G and B, and it basically comes from the fact that G and B are related. So once you've embedded it into the 26-dimensional bosonic string, you can just talk about 018, 18 symmetries. So you can just talk about the bosonic string, and you can just ask what's possible. So we've come up with some examples. So, well, what generates this group? Well, first there's shifts in the B field. You know, it's what we're used to, where the shifts are integer charge. So we know that the B field term is a, if it's constant, is a total derivative, so it just gives an overall factor, and if you reduce it to an integer, when you compute the path integral, it doesn't affect anything. So also you have these basis changes on your internal lattice. So I could always switch the 3 and 4 direction on my internal lattice and it shouldn't change anything. And then there's also T-duality. And I've written down here an example. If you just perform T-duality on the T2 fiber, this is how all the components in that big metric I wrote before come out. There's slightly more supergravity to do. For the heterotic string, you have the same two equations we saw before describing rho and tau, but you also have this Gugino variation. And you can show that it tells you that your Wilson lines along the fiber are flat, and your Wilson line along the base are flat, and the Wilson lines along the fiber are constant. So again, as with rho and tau being constant, we have the Wilson lines along the fiber being constant. So any monodromy that involves that is going to, any monodromy that involves that is just going to lie at a fixed point. So I've kind of up here, I've written up a few examples, just simple examples where one example here is you just invert the fiber torus, and you get the same answer as you did for the type 2 case.
Can you read the top line fast?
Monadrifold, 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 monadrifold. I didn't make it. That's hard. And I don't think I was including the emphasis either. So we'll see. But you can get more complicated. And I've written down some examples. So by here, your B field and your Wilson lines are fixed to be zero. By including a shift here, again, all your moduli are fixed, but your metric gets a slightly different volume, and your B field is no longer zero, and the Wilson's line is still zero. And then by doing a basis change too, you end up with more freedom in defining your metric.
Do all of these examples have the feature that your first one did, that if you just look at the solution and don't know where it came from, it would look like an ordinary compactification? But it's only, this affects the spectrum.
Yeah. So in this, from the lower dimensional perspective, it has a different, has a completely different spectrum. But if you were just to look at what I've written down, it just looks like some string background. There's nothing you can see that's non-geometric. So you could take that as a plus or minus. Right. Joe tells me all the time he doesn't like non-geometric things.
I'm confused what that means. What else are you looking at?
Well, you are looking at this, but from the higher dimensional perspective, I guess the point is you can write down a metric.
You can look at the vacuum without the fluctuations.
Yeah.
Right. And you just look at the solution that you start with before you start perturbing it, and it looks like some ordinary unitorial compactification with some constant E field or something.
Yeah, but you're getting a Q line field.
No, but what I'm saying is, like, if these weren't at some fixed point, you wouldn't be able to write down a metric. You wouldn't be able to do what Gary's saying. But what we're saying is, if I wrote this down and didn't tell you where it came from, like, what's the, people are slightly loose in their use of the word modulus. There's a background metric you start with, like, and you can specify that. I can pick rho to be I. I can pick that, and I can compactify it. And then I can dimensionally reduce and say what happens. And then there's a modulus which corresponds to rho fluctuating. And what we're saying is, if you were to look at this, you're writing down some background that looks just like an ordinary background. You just pick some solution. And it just happens to be that when you look at the lower dimensional theory, there's no fluctuation.
So in a sense, these non-geometric compactifications on a torus are more geometric
than yes.
Non-geometric ones on a sphere.
Where yes.
It really wasn't a geometric description.
Yeah. Yeah. In some sense, yeah. So, I mean, it's nice. There's the fact that, a way to think about what we're doing. I mean, all we're doing is taking, some T2 compactification and just picking a solution. So, I mean, we're taking some solution and then compactifying around it, so.
So there is a geometric compactification that's the same.
If I said, I have this metric in B field, you would have no idea of knowing whether or not it was geometric or not.
Wait, how does the least 2M theory look like? Can you do a least 2M theory if this is a 2A description?
Right.
And the T-duality that is part of it can it's the mapping class group of the torus.
So,
can we see something like that and we get some twisted compactification?
I haven't thought about M theory too much with it. There was a I don't know. I don't know the answer, but there's some there should be some description in terms of M theory, and but I don't know if it would be insightful. It might allow you to. I mean, one of the things we talked about in our first paper was switching with the M theory circle and like doing a 9/11 flop and coming up with some dual theories that way. I don't know. Other than that, I mean, if you went to M theory, you could make it. Like, you could probably try to do some non-geometric M-theory where you actually did something non-geometric with the M-theory circle as well, but, which I guess could allow you to fix the dilaton, maybe. Okay, so I've given some solutions. I've talked a lot about supergravity. I mean, that's kind of a nice thing about this. Normally, when you're talking about non-geometric compactifications, you think about, you're thinking from on asymmetrical folds, and you have to think about it from the string theory perspective. So kind of one of the things we've done in these papers is allow you to give a space-time interpretations to certain non-geometric backgrounds. And we know how powerful the space-time perspective has been in the last, you know, 5, 9, 10 years, you know, in actually figuring fundamental things out about string theory. But you certainly should ask, is there a world sheet description? And I claim there should be. So for starters, there's the 12 plus 12 prime model. Is there a world sheet description of that? And I'll say a little bit about what I think could happen at the end of this talk. It was kind of brought up before. But is there a world sheet description of these monodic folds we discussed with the T2 base? And everything's at fixed points, and it seems like all these are is a space-time descriptions of interpolating asymmetric orbifolds. So if you don't want to know what an interpolating orbifold is, I'll give you a very brief description here. So let's just think about symmetric orbifolds for a second. I've tried to draw, kind of given a picture version of some states which are symmetric under some, okay, I should have said at the beginning. An interpolating asymmetric orbifold is where it's just an orbifold, but the orbifold includes a shift in like a base circle. So you start with, you know, instead of doing R mod Z2, you take like R cross S1 and you mod out by a Z2 element, which is equal to, say, an inversion and a half shift around the S1. So what effect does this have? It doesn't seem special. At that point, it's just some Z2 orbifold with an action you're not as used to as the others. So, well, let's describe some things which are symmetric under such an orbifold. So I've tried to draw some string state here where there's the same string state up here. So this is supposed to be reflecting and then going up one. So this is going to be symmetric. And then same thing here. And then for the minus states, there should be a minus sign there, but you have some string state here, and you have a string state with basically the opposite sign as you reflect and go up.
Which direction is the S1?
Oh, so the S1 is this direction and the and there. But I don't actually think it makes a difference in this picture. But that's the way I've been thinking about it. So this is just the story with the ordinary orbifold. These are in different places. This is up here instead of down here, but it's still pretty standard. So what happens with interpolating orbifolds? Well, your twisted sectors, instead of going straight across, have to go from here up to the analogous point up in this point. So it's necessarily going to wind halfway around the circle. So, well, why do you care? And the reason you care, this is because you now have this parameter R, which you can vary, and it interpolates between different theories, which is where it gets its name, interpolating asymmetric orbifolds. So let R go to 0. What does this look like? Well, as R goes to 0, all these guys kind of move together, and your twisted sector looks here. And it looks exactly like the orbifold you started with without the shift. So it, the r equals zero limit, it's impossible to tell the difference between the r equals zero limit without the shift. As you take r to infinity, though, what happens? Well, the twisted sectors get infinitely heavy. They drop out of the theory. This having to correlate with things over here, which projects out states like this, well, those correlations get pushed off to infinity. And the only thing you're left with is just your ordinary closed string spectrum. So the point is that you start with the theory at r equals 0, where you have an orbifold, and you can take r to infinity, and you end up with a theory where there's no orbifold at all. And people did a lot of work using this to interpolate between theories with different amount of supersymmetry. So there's an obvious guess for what r orbifold can be. We know that t-duality takes x left minus x left and keeps x right the same. Well, why don't we just take a theory which has a circle, and you integrate that, you do an asymmetric orbifold on the left-hand side of the string, and you integrate that with a shift. So basically, as r goes to infinity, you just end up with the theory you started with, and at small r, you end up with this asymmetric orbifold, which as you wrap around the thing, you go from x left to minus x left. So it looks like t-duality. So it seems like a very reasonable guess if you were just going to look at the simplest monodromy of just undergoing t-duality. But it doesn't work. So this is the reason this talk is being given now instead of in December. Because we spent about 3 months thinking about asymmetric orbifolds, and they're really confusing. And though people talk about them a lot, it's very hard to find anyone who actually writes down a partition function. And when you do, it's very rare they agree. So our guess, well, for starters, we have different ideas. So there's more you can do. We picked the simplest, where you just pick an inversion. You could put phases and stuff in there, and maybe you can get something that works. I mean, the reason you know this doesn't work is because it's not modular, right? But there's other things to do, too. We could have, instead of picked, we could work in some plane and pick like a Zn orbifold, right? And as long as the Zn orbifold had the properties, after you went the distance 2 pi r, you got x left to minus x left, it seemingly has the right behavior. Now, there's all these extra fixed points, which may or may not cause problems. But if we're able to calculate this correctly and come up with a consistent theory, then we can ask the question, does this have the right moduli, and see if it's correct. So there's several ways. I don't believe the fact that we don't have an interpolating asymmetric orbifold description means that there's not one, but we just haven't found it. But so I think, you know, in our paper, which should be out in 2 weeks, we're just going to basically describe that we think it's got this behavior. And hopefully, we're working through trying to understand asymmetric orbifolds better now, and hopefully we're going to have a paper out in a couple months, which is solely on asymmetric orbifolds. And as soon as we get that out, if we're able to get that out and it works, then we can just write down a world sheet description.
So again, the three axis is you go around the circle and you t-dual on two axes?
Yeah. So, yeah. And it turned...
It's not modular invariant.
It's not modular invariant.
But 4 is that?
4 is modular invariant, but you have to include funny phases to get it to work.
This is something which is just totally non-obvious, sort of, from the point of view of...
It's very non-obvious.
Maybe doing the patient, but it comes... Yeah.
I mean, we assumed all you guys had worked this out for us a long time ago. We thought, like, the generation before us had all this stuff, and we were just going to be able to look through papers and write down the answer, which is... Yeah, it's very non.
Not in my book for a reason.
Yeah. but yeah, so it's.
Did you talk about asymmetric orbifolds at all in your book?
He mentions them. There's a sentence.
The following is trivially generalized. Yeah.
Now, this is a special case. So.
In the bosonic string, if you're at the self-dual radius, isn't T-duality part of the SU2 gauge group that you get?
Yes, it is.
And so going around a circle and having an SU2 gauge transformation, that's just a Wilson line, that seems innocuous.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the fermions that the problem? And also the heterotic string, actually, right? The heterotic string also, you have a self-dual radius of SU2, and so going around a circle and having an SU2 transformation seems like something that should be physically sensible.
Right,
it does. And therefore modular variant.
It's true. So one of the problems is, what is your twisted sector? All right, now there's an obvious twisted sector, and this is something, the symmetric orifold's really nice, because the twisted sector is what it is. Like, when you first learn about orifolds, you say, well, first I'm going to project out by this, but then I realized I could have these strings that looked open before, which are closed now. And so you just write that down, you've got to project that, and it's this very obvious thing. But as you said to me over dinner a couple months ago, was, the twisted sector is what makes your theory modular invariant. So one of the things that happens, in particular working out this stuff Witten and Vafa did, is you don't pick the projection that you think you would pick in the twisted sector. You have to pick a different projection to get it to be modular invariant. So there's lots of questions like this, but so I don't know exactly where the problem's coming from, but I know writing down the projection function, the projector 1 plus this Z2 operation, and projecting that on the twisted and untwisted sector and orbifolding doesn't give you the right answer. So it gives you something which is not modular invariant.
For the simple case that you're looking at where you can bosonize and replace the two dimensions with 4 fermions or the 4 dimensions with 8 fermions, and you're sort of doing a projection by minus 1 to the F on the fermions, and we know that modular invariants only works if there are groups of 8.
Yes, so I think it's related.
And I don't have a deep understanding of that. It's just that you get an eighth root of unity. And,
right.
I mean, there's presumably some topological, I mean, presumably there's some deeper way to say when these things work and when they don't. But
I think you're exactly right, and this is hopefully, if we're able to make progress, this is what we're going to try to do in our asymmetric orifold papers. Because what you're doing is restating the problem we're having with bosonic sector in terms of some fermionized version.
Known to be confusing.
So.
Another question. So you started off by saying that some of these asymmetric orifolds have duals, which are ordinary sort of flux compactifications.
Okay. Some of the non-geometric. And that simply lies from, that's easy to understand what's happening. So they start with backgrounds which have some monodromy in tau. And so this, it lies in some SL2Z. And when you do T-dualities, it takes this monodromy you're taking some monodromy M to something that looks like A transpose or something, right? Where this is the action coming from the, not necessarily T-duality, but just some non-geometric symmetry. And what happens is this new element no longer lies in the SL2Z. If you do it an odd number of times. And if you do it an even number of times, it does. And Shamit in their papers, all they did was say, these are non-geometric. It might be something like, we did, but they're just going to ignore them and do the geometric case. What Simeon did was he actually wrote the conifold, and he explicitly wrote down the conifold in terms of a T3 vibration. And called it mirror symmetry when he T-dualized on 3 of the fibers. It's because it's a conifold, the base is actually non-compact. But you end up with monodromies which don't lie into the geometric SL3Z you get from the T3 fibration. So, but again, we don't, these aren't cases where, like with the asymmetric roll fill, we have some explicit description. You just know there's points that as you go around in a circle, you don't come back up to the geometric symmetries. Okay, I'm way over time. My conclusion is a couple of future statements. We'd like to know what the string-string duality is. I'd written down this orbifold and where we almost had the string-string duality in some sense. On the type 2a side, if you take the S1 to infinity, it just becomes the 12 plus 12 prime side. On the heterotic side, the naive thing would be to take the S1 that's multiplying the T4, basically, to infinity. But that's not modular invariant. So all we really know is that we have to take a cycle on the heterotic side and blow that up. So we're hoping before the paper comes out, we're going to figure out the right cycle to blow up and actually have a handle on this. We want to get this world description, sheet description, right? And then there's lots of stuff. Talking about world sheet physics, you were asking about the moduli space before. I think something would be very interesting is, you know, there's these Gepner models where you can take something like the K3 and you can describe. There's this nice correspondence. I think you could probably, it'd be nice to see if you could do something like that, where you had this equivalence where you could work out what the super potential was and whatnot. You could put fluxes on these, see what happens. We could understand relationship with other compactifications, like these twisted flux compactifications I was mentioning earlier. But, you know, I really think this is, if you only consider geometric backgrounds, when people go around saying string theory lives in 10 dimensions, it's kind of a lie. You know, really, string theory has a bunch of fields which can sometimes be given a 10-dimensional geometric interpretation. And because we understand geometry so well, that's what everyone concentrates on. But there's no reason to really favor that. And I think if you really want a full understanding of string theory, what we need to do is, even this kind of relied on old knowledge. I think we need to develop a framework which isn't kind of based on the metric and geometry, but is more intrinsic, where the intrinsic object is actually the complexified Kähler form. And I think this is the kind of thing that, and now I'm forgetting his name, mathematician at Cambridge, came and gave a talk this summer. Yeah, Hitchin. Hitchin gave a talk on these generalized Calabi-Yau manifolds. And I don't think it's quite the same thing, but I think that's the right step. Like, I think he's going in the right direction. And so I think that's a huge thing that's far off, but I think it's something everyone should think about. Okay, so that's it.